mine of this size and scope of the Pebble Mine would have significant and irreversible negative impacts on the Bristol Bay watershed and its salmon-bearing waters.
The EPA invokes the Clean Water Act in the Pebble Mine process. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reaction to the EPA decision was swift.
This is well outside the established process because we have not yet filed an application to develop the prospect at Pebble.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
Officials with the Environmental Protection Agency announced today they are starting a formal process to look at using EPA's authority under the Clean Water Act to stop development of the proposed Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The announcement was made by EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy during a hastily called press conference Friday. She says the move is a significant step in ensuring that the world's most productive salmon fishery is safe from the risks that it faces from what could be one of the largest mines on Earth. McCarthy notes the action is in direct response to the request made in 2010 by several tribes in the Bristol Bay region for the agency to use authority granted it under a section of the Clean Water Act. To guide its decision-making, the EPA put together the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment, which was released last month. The assessment documented the potential negative impacts from a large mine in the region. McCarthy says the assessment showed the Bristol Bay watershed is among the most productive watersheds on the planet.
We learn what makes that ecosystem tick and why it's the most prolific salmon factory in the world. You know, extensive existing data, including information that was collected as part of EPA's three-year scientific assessment, provided ample reason for EPA to believe that the mine of this size and scope of the Pebble Mine would have significant and irreversible negative impacts on the Bristol Bay watershed and its salmon-bearing waters.
EPA is sending a letter about its decision to the state of Alaska, the Pebble Limited Partnership, and the Corps of Engineers, which has the authority to issue the dredge and fill permits that would be needed for a mine the size of the proposed Pebble Mine to go forward. During Friday's press conference, McCarthy characterized the salmon that return every summer to Bristol Bay as a tremendous resource.
And it's worthy of out-of-the-ordinary agency actions to protect it. And no one should read into this action any change in the mining permit processes, either contemplated or underway in any other location. Bristol Bay is a very unique situation. This is a unique mine in a very unique place. That is what this process is speaking to.
The Bristol Bay region produces nearly 50% of the world's sockeye salmon, and that salmon is the cornerstone of the economy in the region and the way of life of the people that call the region home. The 404C process that will be used by the EPA was outlined in detail during Friday's press conference by EPA Region 10 Administrator Dennis McLaren. He says the review process will include public hearings and a public comment period. He stressed that the input of the Pebble Limited Partnership, the Corps of Engineers, and the state of Alaska will be encouraged. Since passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972, the EPA has only used its authority under Section 404C a total of 13 times, and the agency is coming under criticism for exploring the use of the authority this time because the Pebble Limited Partnership has not yet filed for permits. EPA Administrator McCarthy confirms that once in the past, the agency has used its 404C authority before permits have been applied for.
I think there's many good reasons why we should move forward with this. Number one is we've spent 3 years looking at this watershed, understanding the significance of mining this deposit and what it might mean for this watershed. We know how precious Bristol Bay is, and perhaps even equally important, it's raised uncertainties for the tribes It's raised considerable uncertainties for the many thousands of people who rely on this fishery for commercial fishing opportunities.
The EPA confirms that with the start of the 404C process, the Army Corps of Engineers cannot issue a permit to fill in wetlands or streams associated with mining the Pebble deposit until the review process is complete. The Pebble Limited Partnership has said their goal for the year ahead is to advance the project into permitting, but that will likely be on hold until the EPA's review is complete. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The EPA's announcement today was directly targeted at the Pebble Mine. The developers of that project are not pleased with what they say is a gross overreach of federal authority. Mike Heatwall is Vice President of Public Affairs at the Pebble Limited Partnership.
The initiation of this 404 process is indeed unprecedented. It's an unprecedented federal action and clearly has far-ranging implications well beyond Pebble.
To date, Pebble has spent more than $500 million studying the environment and developing mining scenarios. They say they understand the importance of Bristol Bay salmon and don't expect to get permitted if their mine can't coexist with the fish habitat. What they do expect is a chance to play by long-established rules.
The strength of the U.S. system and what attracts foreign investment is the ability to work your way through a very prescribed process, and that is not what has happened here. This is well outside the established process because we have not yet filed an application to develop the prospect at Pebble.
Alaska Congressman Don Young says the EPA is setting a dangerous precedent that has nothing to do with the Pebble Mine. In Young's view, the federal government is stepping on the state's authority over its own land to such an extent it threatens what it means to be a state at all.
We could possibly lose utilization of any of our other state lands wherever there was a watershed period by some interest group saying, no, this can't be done. And that goes for airports, schools, any type of activity on any of our state lands. That could occur.
Likewise, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said in a written statement today that if the EPA action is allowed to stand, it'll threaten development across Alaska and anywhere in the nation. Senator Mark Begich is the only member of Alaska's federal delegation who has come out against the mine. He said today he'll be watching to make sure the agency doesn't overreach. But Begich says the EPA is acting within its rights so far. Begich says Pebble can continue to work on its permit applications. He says the EPA isn't exercising a veto as much as it's drawing up a list of requirements the mine will have to meet to discharge into wetlands. The Alaska Native Sport and Commercial Fishing and Environmental groups who have led the charge against Pebble were cautiously optimistic following today's announcement. Kim Williams is the executive director for an association of Bristol Bay tribes and village corporations known as Nunumta Aluxtai. She is among those who've specifically asked the EPA to issue 404C protections to block Pebble's development out of concern that the state agencies would rubber stamp the project.
It was our last hope. They need that one permit to put their dredge and fill somewhere up in that mine area, and it will impact water, and that was our only recourse to go to EPA.
That today's announcement didn't quite close the book on Pebble wasn't lost on the mine's opposition. Robin Samuelson, one of the tribal leaders who signed the 2010 request asking the EPA to intervene, says they are ready and able to keep up the fight.
We've been in this battle for 14 years. If it lasts another 20, I'll be there. And when I'm gone, my grandchildren will be there. We'll never give up the fight.
Starting this year, foreign nationals who wish to drive in Alaska may be getting a closer look at their paperwork when they go to the DMV. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that a bill pegging the expiration date of a driver's license to a person's immigration status is a step away from the governor's desk.
The point of the legislation is to make sure immigrants who aren't legally allowed to be in the United States don't use an Alaska driver's license as a cover. Senator Fred Dyson, a Republican from Eagle River, carried the bill.
We have a responsibility to see that our major means of identification is not used inappropriately.
Instead of letting a foreign national get a license for 5 years after they pass their driver's test, the DMV would match the license expiration date to the exit date on their visa. If a foreign national is allowed to stay in the United States indefinitely, they would have to get their driver's license renewed by the DMV every year. Bill Bilikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, was one of a handful of senators to oppose the bill. He says bringing immigration status into the licensing process goes beyond the DMV's mission of road safety.
It turns the Department of Motor Vehicles into an arm of the Federal Immigration and Naturalization Service.
He believes the law could create difficulties for foreign workers and international students, and that it could open the state up to lawsuits. The American Civil Liberties Union has already come out against the legislation, arguing that it could pose an equal protection problem by making immigrants jump through extra hoops. Wilikowski also anticipates it will increase the workload at the DMV.
This bill requires DMV to become expert in more than 80 different types of immigration and other statuses.
In response, supporters of the bill stressed its simplicity and noted that dozens of other states already have similar laws on the books. The legislation passed 13-4, with the vote breaking down mostly on caucus lines. MATSU Senator Mike Dunleavy was the lone Republican to join the Democratic minority in opposition to the measure. It passed the House by a sizable majority last year. The bill isn't the only piece of DMV policy the legislature is considering. One bill in the House would allow military spouses to keep their out-of-state licenses. Another in the Senate would provide subsidies to third-party contractors who do vehicle registrations for people who don't want to wait in line at the DMV. That bill would let those contractors keep 15% of the revenue from those transactions, and it would cost the state over $1 million. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The White House has nominated the Coast Guard's Pacific Area Commander to be its next commandant. Vice Admiral Paul Zukunft was nominated today to replace outgoing Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp. Papp gave his final State of the Coast Guard address of his four-year term on Wednesday. Zukunft has served as Pacific Area Commander since 2012. Before that, his duties including serving as the Federal On-Scene Coordinator for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010. Zukunft was in Alaska last month to cut the ribbon on the new Coast Guard Sector Anchorage headquarters at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Senator Lisa Murkowski attended. She called Zukunft's nomination good news for Alaska in a statement today. Zukunft's nomination requires confirmation by the Senate. He would be the Coast Guard's 25th commandant. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new bishop in Sitka.
Thinking about all those names and the history and the tradition that I've now become a part of is just an overwhelming feeling of humbleness.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
People from across Alaska and the lower 48 assembled in Fairbanks today to bid final farewell to former territorial governor Mike Stepovich. Stepovich died February 14th at the age of 94 in California. His body was returned to Fairbanks, where he was buried today. Stepovich was born in Fairbanks and spent much of his life there raising 13 kids with his wife Matilda while working as an attorney and politician. He's being remembered as a pioneer and public servant who dedicated his life to Alaska. After serving three terms in the territorial legislature, Stepovich was named Alaska's final territorial governor in 1957 by President Dwight Eisenhower. In 1958, Stepovich resigned from the governor's office to run for the U.S. Senate. He was defeated that year by Ernest Gruening and by Bill Egan 2 years later. In 1966, Stefovich ran for governor but lost to fellow Republican Wally Hickel in the gubernatorial primary. Stefovich is survived by all 13 of his children. Legislation allowing a popular Air Ambulance Services membership program to resume coverage passed the state Senate today. Seattle-based Airlift Northwest began the Air Care program in 2008. The state told it to begin shutting down last year. Air Care covered the difference between medevac flights' costs and the amount insurance covers. Those flights can run $100,000 or more, so deductibles or copays are large. Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman sponsored the bill that passed unopposed today.
A lot of us are stuck on islands and in remote areas. We don't have close proximity to some of the major hospitals like in Anchorage, and we use a lot of the medevac flight services to get out.
Senate Bill 159 does not name Air Care, but allows all such membership programs to operate in Alaska. Insurance officials decided the program did not meet state standards last November. It allowed existing subscribers to keep their memberships until they ran out, but renewals and new memberships were prohibited. Senate Minority Leader Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, criticized that decision.
What bothered me the most was the degree to which the Division of Insurance was going out of its way to pick on this company. They are a nonprofit. They operate out of Washington State. There was an avenue, I think, under existing statutes that would have allowed them to continue.
Airlift Northwest is part of the University of Washington Medical System. Today is the last day that the Alaska State Museum in Juneau will be open to the public. The museum will be permanently closed to the public this weekend as staff continue boxing up the facility's artifacts for this summer's big move. The 24,000-square-foot current museum is in downtown Juneau will be torn down to make way for a new 180,000-square-foot structure now under construction on the same site. Museum curator Bob Banghart says they'll begin moving artifacts into the new vault in May. All of the permanent exhibits on the second floor have been dismantled, and many of the artifacts in the basement collection have been carefully packed up and prepared for the big move.
That 6 weeks is our actual moving time, so we have to have everything done in advance. So think of it like a play. You'll spend months and months and months in rehearsal and development and everything, and the play only lasts for like 6 weeks, and then it's done.
The construction of the new $138 million State Libraries, Archives, and Museum, sometimes referred to as SLAM, is already underway. Completion is set for April 2016. Willow runner Dave Johnston has set a new foot record in the 350-mile Iditarod Trail Invitational Race. Dragging a sled over snow, ice, and dirt trail, Johnston covered the distance in 4 days, 1 hour, and 38 minutes. That's over 87 miles per day. Johnston bested the old record set by Steve Reifenstuhl of Sitka in 2005 by more than 14 hours.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Zachariah Hughes. This week on AK, a new bishop. Last Sunday, the Orthodox Diocese of Sitka and Alaska installed David Mahaffey as its 16th bishop. A historic and ornate ceremony ensued in Sitka, attracting Orthodox bishops from New York to Quebec. On the steps of St. Michael's Cathedral, Native elders welcomed Metropolitan Tikhon, the head of the Orthodox Church in America, with traditional bread and salt. Emily Foreman spoke with Mahaffey about his journey to bishophood.
David Mahaffey had never dreamed of becoming a bishop, because he's always been a family man.
on the night before his official installment as the Bishop of Sitka in Alaska by the yellow light of the Subway Sandwiches sign outside of his hotel window, Mahaffey looks over a plaque given to him by the National Park Service. It lists all of the Orthodox bishops in Alaska ever.
From the first one in 1799.
Dating back to the Russian colonial period.
To me in 2014.
It's an enormous privilege that comes with enormous responsibility.
Being able to be here in Sitka and thinking about all those names and the history and the tradition that I've now become a part of is just an overwhelming feeling of humbleness.
Mahaffey is the 16th bishop of America's first Orthodox diocese, and America's first Orthodox bishop, St. Innocent, resided in Sitka. Father Michael Boyle, the priest and dean of Sitka's historic St. Michael's Cathedral, says that makes Sitka the motherland of Orthodoxy in the United States.
St. Innocent came to Alaska as the second wave of missionaries. They asked him to become bishop of this new diocese of the Russian Church in Alaska, which he questioned whether he could do or not because he was concerned for his children and their care.
Over a century later, Mahaffey admits to the same trepidations, namely the distance from his grown children and first grandchild who live in Pennsylvania. And on Sunday, he treaded in St. Innocent's footsteps. Alongside Orthodox bishops and clergy dressed in golden robes, Mahaffey marched from the Russian Bishop's House to St. Michael's Cathedral in Sitka. This procession has been in place since the first Orthodox bishop was installed. In less than two city blocks, it would be official. But for Mahaffey, it's the culmination of decades of personal exploration. When Mahaffey's wife passed away in 2007, a door opened. He could make the move from priest to bishop by accepting a monastic lifestyle.
When I became widowed, one of the things that happens is you quote-unquote become eligible.
But Mahaffey would have preferred to have his wife rather than an open door.
She was everything to me.
And that's not an overstatement. Mahaffey was raised Methodist. His wife was Orthodox. After they married, he realized that Orthodoxy had something to offer that the Methodist faith lacked. At his first Orthodox service, Mahaffey says he was instantly hooked.
I was just like a sponge. I'm absorbing all this, and it's like, oh man, this is what I want.
That same day, on their way to his mother's, Mahaffey says his wife expressed that she didn't want to be seen as having influenced his conversion.
We get to my mother's, and I go in, and my wife was a hairdresser, so, and my mother wanted her hair done, so my wife got her stuff out, and she's looking at me, she's like, she knows what I'm going to say, so she's behind my mother. My mother can't see her, and she's looking at me like, don't do this. And I said, Mom, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I've decided that I want to become Orthodox, and I want to be a priest someday. Now, I'd never said that before.
Mahaffey converted, but left his priesthood up to fate. He had a secular job working as a car salesman, but felt unfulfilled. It was his wife who suggested that he go to seminary. After his wife died, the Diocese of Sitka in Alaska wanted him for bishop. He was still reluctant because he didn't want to leave his kids, but a friend convinced him to at least visit. So last year, in Kodiak, on the anniversary of his wife's repose, during the celebration of St. Herman's pilgrimage, it finally clicked.
Look, let me explain it to you. This is going on kind of, I don't know if it was St. Herman or my wife or God or whoever saying, don't you get it? You know, you had a beautiful wife who was beautiful inside and out, and she really was. So what came to me was this sense that, look, I've replaced your wife's physical beauty with the beauty of Alaska. And I've replaced her inner beauty with the beauty of the people of Alaska. Isn't that what you want?
From that point forward, it felt right. Mahaffey was meant to be in Alaska. For AK, I'm Emily Foreman.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Takotna, a village of around 50 people located on the Iditarod Trail west of McGrath.
My name's Nell Huffman. I live in the village of Takotna. I am the secretary for the Takotna Community Association. Tekotna is a beautiful village. We're right on the Tekotna River. We have Tekotna Mountain just to the south that we can see. Mount Joaquin is off to the southeast. We have roads, 100 miles of roads out here that go through a lot of mountain hilly terrain. There's some local employment out at the mines. There's lots of fishing on the river. We have a fish weir that we've operated for fishing game for a long, long time. This is the first year the village might be taking it over on our own. Tekotna hosts the mushers on the trail. Our theory is we cater to the mushers and not everybody else. They come here, we try to keep press and visitors and everybody away from them. Every musher gets a steak while they're here, and we have a kitchen going 24/7. We have full breakfast with eggs, potatoes, bacon. We're famous for pies. Jan Newton started serving pies many years ago, and everybody who lives in Tekotna is a pie maker. She taught kids how to make pies when they were little. Our kids this year are playing basketball, but it takes several villages to make a team. So our kids go over and play with the McGrath kids, and the kids from Nikolai go too. So it takes more kids to make a team. It's kind of fun to watch them here. They dribble a basketball on the carpet. We don't have a gym, so they learn dribbling on the carpet, and they do a lot of running and other exercise, and then they go to McGrath and actually learn how to play. I like it because I think it's a healthy community. Our school is very good and our kids thrive. Yeah, we're proud of what we do.
Nell Huffman is the secretary of the Tekotna Community Association. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jolene Almendarez and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Matt Miller and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Zachariah Hughes was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doi Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a mental health trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.